All right, I call this meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order. We have a quorum. First is we have minutes from March 5th, 2026. Has anyone had a chance to look at the minutes, like to make a motion? Representative Carroll?
Thank you, Co-Chair. Yes, I'll move the minutes.
Okay, we have a motion to approve the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. First bill on the agenda is House File 3448. Chair Akam, you want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will remember to move my bill today. Yes, I move House File 3458 be moved to the General Register.
Okay. Chair Akam moves that House File 3458 be re-referred to the General Register. I understand there's an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I do have a minor amendment to get the bill in the shape with which we would like to discuss it. Maybe we'll go ahead and move the amendment, and then we can talk about the bill in total.
Okay. Chair Akam moves Amendment A1. Any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the A1 is adopted. So, Chair Akam, now to your bill as amended.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, members, this bill, House File 3458, as amended, exempts tribes from the exclusive rights and assigned service areas for utilities. And the reason for this bill, it came out of an issue with the Upper Sioux Tribe and the Minnesota Valley Co-op with concerns about a solar project that was built at the casino, at the tribal casino. And so there have been some conflicts over that. As as members will see in your packets, there's an article from the Star Tribune last year that does a good job of kind of laying out the situation and the path and the process at the Public Utility Commission. And as we know, the Public Utility Commission, as the regulator, can have a voice here, and they are working on that, and the legislature can also do that. And so this bill is the legislative fix to ensure that sovereign nations are not made to abide by the exclusive rights and service territories of utilities. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to testifiers. And
thank you, Madam Chair. First testifier is Chairman Jensvold. Please introduce yourself and then go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Sudzinski, Chair Akam, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Jensvold. I am the tribal chairman of the Yellow Medicine Dakota people, known federally as in CFR as the Upper Sioux Community. I serve as the tribal chairman. I've been honored by the people with that position now for nearly 21 years. In the course of that time, I've had the pleasure to come here on occasion to advocate on behalf of our people, on behalf of, I guess, not only the Upper Sioux community, but potentially also on behalf of the other 10 tribal nations that are either bordered or bounded by the state of Minnesota. In those 20 years, there's been three occasions where I've had to bring to the attention of the state of Minnesota flaws or errors or omissions in regards to the laws that all of you create here on behalf of all the citizens of Minnesota. I know one of them was in regards to Indian Affairs Council, where a word was changed from will to may. I know that one of those laws that was changed or modified was in regards to right-of-ways and ability for the state to transfer those right-of-ways to tribal nations. Another time was regards to MPCA and their mistaken belief that they had jurisdiction over our permitting process for effluent into the river system. So it's incumbent upon me as a tribal chairman, as a father, as a elected official and an advocate for 573 tribal members that, again, on this occasion, I come to bring to your attention this issue here. And I've said to many people, this is not about solar. This is about sovereignty. It just happens to be that the Upper Sioux community constructed a solar generator to offset consumption with our utility, and our utility then came to our lands, basically gave us a cease and desist, or they would turn our power off. And I guess that's where I started to question why that was, and their response is that they have, and this word exclusive rights, I say to each of you with no offense intended that you have no exclusive rights when it comes to tribal nations. Each of us has sovereign rights. Tribes' sovereignty comes from the inherent right long before the Constitution of the United States was ever ratified. States have sovereignty based on different rights. But it does trouble me, again, as an advocate for tribal members well into the future, that if I don't sit here today and make these statements and make it known that of the flaws, and I don't, and I've always said the truth is very simple and it just sits there. I don't blame anybody for laws that were enacted 50-some years ago. Times were different then. Tribes probably were very dependent upon the federal government for their mere existence. But today, me as a tribal leader, I've been put in a position where I have knowledge. But I will say this, I'm probably the least educated person in this room. But I have knowledge and historical reference to say that tribal law matters. This is a civil regulatory issue, and that has been adjudicated at the highest court in the land that those that right exists solely with the tribes within their exterior boundaries. It exists nowhere else. You can look at the Cabazon case, and if you all know anything about that, you'll realize that that's why these gaming enterprises exist within your borders. There's also a very relevant case to this specific issue, 1995 in North Dakota, Devil's Lake Tribe versus their Public Utility Commission, that also reinforces that law that says this is exclusive to the tribes. I sit here in a fortunate situation, though, because I do know that in this room and in this place that the powers that be are influenced by political alliances. I want to assure you that this is neither a Democrat nor a Republican issue. This is simply an acknowledgement that I am requesting the state of Minnesota pursue on our behalf, that the civil regulatory authority is acknowledged. Whether you move forward and support that, it doesn't change the fact and legal precedent that's been set that this is the case. I'm here to extend the courtesy to your decision makers that there are laws like this that come up from time to time that didn't factor in the unique status of tribal nations when they were passed into law many years ago. But again, in this day and age, I have the extreme belief that as human beings, we're moving into a future where our children are dependent upon us to to be open-minded, to understand the complexity of tribes and how this country was created at the expense of them, and how certain laws do apply and certain laws don't. Again, it's greater than the solar issue in front of you today, but I do appreciate the opportunity to bring it forth to each of you. If you have questions of me, I'd be certainly do my best to answer. Again, like I prefaced before, I'm not the most educated, but that is the issue, and the crux of it is that these laws have already been tested in different jurisdictions, like I said, at the highest level, the Supreme Court. And so I'm asking you, not as Democrats or Republicans, but as human beings who have been chosen and selected and pursued these positions of responsibility and authority to advocate on behalf of correcting an omission that was put in this law in 50 years ago. The problem is I've been approached, and it seems like this is monumental, and I don't understand that, because I don't know that things would necessarily change. But when you have a system that is designed with exclusivity, and we are told that this is the only option, I don't think, based on somebody else's law, I would imagine that you would all understand the consternation that that brings to our people. Again, I truly believe that they consider us a member of their co-op, and in no way, shape, or form do we meet any of the criteria within their own bylaws. But they are emboldened by state law, and they've made that quite clearly known that this is how that they were given this territory. And again, that flaw was exposed when we pursued this project, and I just want you to be made aware of that. If you choose not to support it, it doesn't change the fact that right exists. All that does is consume time, and lawyers like that, you know. Even my own lawyer, well, you know, when it takes more time, the more resources have to be expended, you know, and lawyers are quite comfortable with dragging it out. But I think it's a very simple request. I think if anybody has been to a political science class of any sort, that they will understand tribal sovereignty. I do believe that it's time to educate ourselves as completely as possible about the unique status and relationship between the state and the tribes that are, you know, bordered or bounded. One of those things too, we helped incorporate the tribal state relations training. The Upper Sioux community had a project with MnDOT, and they could understand how we could fund their project. Again, this unknown things about between people, you know, we're helping to overcome that. So I appreciate your time. I want to thank you all, the familiar faces I know and some that I don't. But one other thing I would like to ask, and this is a moment of levity, as state lawmakers, this land that we sit on right here was my mother's land in 1801. A man by the name of Zebulon Pike there, on behalf of the United States, negotiated an agreement with the Dakota people to cede this land to them. So there's still $198,000 owed to my mother's people. So if you ever get the chance to talk to a federal person in a see if you could get that for us, you know, because it's long overdue, you know. And so I appreciate that. Just want you to know that I bring that up because there's not a lot of things that we know about Native peoples, particularly Dakota people. Minnesota is a Dakota word, and 10 years ago when English was supposed to become the official language here, I sat in a room quite similar to this, and I explained to the powers that be that you're going to have to change the name of your state because Minnesota is not an English word. So there's a lot of learning we need to do. And this is just one example of that. And I do truly think that today's an opportunity to say that as much as we respect tribal sovereignty, today we're going to set forth on a path that also demonstrates we're going to support that. So I thank you all for your time. And I have any questions, you can, I'll wait until the end of the testimony and I'll come back if you need me. But thank you again.
Thank you, Chairman. Next, we have Derek Moe, who's testifying, I believe, virtually. Please, please introduce yourself and then proceed.
Thank you. I am Derek Moe, President and CEO of Minnesota Rural Electric Association. Cooperatives serve 85% of the land of the state, including most of the state's sovereign Indian nations. We are pleased to serve them and work to provide quality service and partner with them to meet their goals. I am concerned about this bill, which would open established electric service territories within Minnesota's Indian nations to multiple service providers. This would hurt the people in those areas by undermining the regulatory compact, a bedrock of electric service for generations, put in place first and foremost to protect consumers. Utilities accept the obligation to reliably and safely serve throughout the assigned areas and in return receive a defined service territory and oversight preventing wasteful duplication of infrastructure and services. This bill undermines reliability. Minnesota's grid is built for universal service and long-term planning. Assigned territories support coordinated investments, right-sizing substations, upgrading poles and wires, maintaining vegetation management, and preparing for extreme weather. If multiple providers are competing for the same load, the incentive shifts from a long-term infrastructure stewardship to short-term sales and goals. Consumers pay the price through higher system costs, increased disputes over responsibility, and fragmented approaches to planning and outage restoration, negatively impacting those within Indian Territory first and foremost, and also risking spreading consequences to consumers around the state. For cooperatives in particular, there's an added concern. We are member-owned, not-for-profit, and locally governed. Our returns go back to the people we serve through capital credits and stable rates. But co-ops still carry long-term obligations, federal and private financing for infrastructure built under the promise of service territories. Undermining that framework would increase financial risk and raise borrowing costs and show up on members' bills. The regulatory compact has consistently delivered good service for consumers. Whatever the intended goals of the bill, we believe there would be a better approach, an approach that would lower the risk of unintended consequences and better serve the state's Indian nations. Thank you, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Justin Johns, also virtual. If you're there, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Justin Johns. I'm with East Central Energy. I serve as the president and CEO. Co-chairs and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House File 3458. East Central Energy is celebrating its 90th year this year, not nearly as long as the Ojibwe and Dakota people have been on these lands, but we're proud of the partnership that we have with the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. So let me begin by saying this clearly. The dispute that catalyzed this bill between the Minnesota Valley Cooperative Light and Power in the Upper Sioux community is not representative of how electric cooperatives across Minnesota have engaged with tribal nations. Our obligation to serve as defined by the service territories in the state of Minnesota have given us cause to develop strong relationships. At East Central Energy, we've built a strong productive relationship with the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. Together, we have developed a 3-megawatt solar generation facility. We're investing in grid resilience specific to the tribal land and advancing technology solutions that benefit both the band and our broader membership. These projects will be accomplished through collaboration, mutual respect, and a shared commitment to service, reliability, and affordability. And I'd like to emphasize that the right to serve and the obligation to serve are what allow us to make these significant investments in infrastructure on tribal lands. Cooperatives are member-owned organizations. Our model is built on partnership, not confrontation. When challenges arise, including distributed generation, behind-the-meter solar, or service questions, co-ops work to find practical, good-faith solutions. Minnesota House File 3458 proposes a broad statutory exception to Minnesota's exclusive service territory framework. While we can certainly understand the frustration that has led to this proposal, we are concerned that rewriting statewide service territory law in response to one dispute could create unintended consequences for reliability, cost allocation, and long-term system planning and investment. When improvements are appropriate, the circumstances of the situation should be thoughtfully considered, and a process is underway now at the Public Utilities Commission to do just that. Undermining service territories would be a significant structural change and likely result in degraded service reliability and higher bills for tribes around the state. We remain committed to strong tribal partnerships and to advancing clean energy in a way that protects reliability and fairness for all member owners. Thanks for your time and consideration, and I'd be also happy to answer any questions.
Okay, that's all we have on the testifier list. Is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. Chair Subzinski.
Thank you, Chair Kraft. Chair Akam, just kind of a question along the lines. You know, it is my understanding that there is something moving forward within the PUC that is working to deal with this. Is that true?
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, or Chair Subzinski. There is a process that is working through at the Public Utility Commission, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
And Chair Akam, do we, I see there's this bill before us. Are we not going to trust what's going to potentially come out of that? Is that why this is before us, or kind of what's the process, you know, as far as kind of circumventing that process through the PUC?
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the question. I will say I don't view this as circumventing. I think that the PUC process is proceeding and has a time horizon, and I think that there's often more than one way that you can solve a problem, and so this is just looking at the legislative approach. I think if, you know, looking at the article that was in packets and other articles that reported on the PUC hearing on the issue, I think it is clear that there was interest by the commission to find a solution that is workable. I think that they're the ones who floated the idea of potentially moving this the casino to another service territory. So I think that there is support there, and I think that we just want to make sure that from whichever way a good workable solution is happens.
More, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Kraft. So that's I appreciate that answer. You know, I think it's interesting that this bill is before us. You know, I do represent Chair Jensvold and folks there, and I do appreciate that this is before us, and I understand that there are conflicts when it comes to the local utility and the community as well. And so we do appreciate that, but, you know, being that there is a process going forward, you know, I think it's important to us to respect that as well, you know, as an institution. We don't always agree with that institution does move forward, but I think it's an important part of what our state does, and when it comes to kind of taking a blind look at the policy positions that are moving forward and how those things are addressed. And, you know, just as the testifier did say online, talking about service territory and broad brushes, you know, I think that's important too. You know, the actions that we do take, and, you know, is it just solar? You know, from that standpoint, or is it, you know, does this open it up to if a tribal nation wanted to build a nuclear plant or a coal plant, does it stop there? I mean, I don't know if this opens it up to that, if we believe that, if we do believe in sovereignty, to what extent does that is? Is that, I don't know. It could mean everything and anything, potentially. So, thank you.
Madam Chair, do you have a comment?
Maybe I'll just briefly respond in that this is really just about the utility service areas. And as the chairman said, this isn't about solar, that this is about sovereignty. And so that's my response.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
I just wanted to ask for a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Roll call hadn't been requested. Roll call will be conducted. Other comments, questions? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More of a statement, and again, it's too bad we do find ourselves here with this difficult conversation only because they couldn't resolve this in other manners. But again, sitting on a utility board like I did before I came to the Minnesota House here, I just know the importance of making sure the greater good for all in that service territory is well balanced. It's got to be carefully thought through. And again, I can't support the bill today because, again, we're a long ways from resolving it in a good way that's going to benefit so many more people, I think, in that area. So just want to be on record of why that is. But it's an important thing to talk about. So, again, I know Mr. Chairman from the Upper Sioux, and they're good people, and I know their problems and their issues there, but we have a lot of people in that district, in that area, and again, around the state that would be affected by something like this. So just wanted to share that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Vice Chair. This is questions for Mr. Johns.
Johns.
Yeah. Okay.
I think Mr. Johns is probably still online.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm here.
Thank you. Mr. Johns, what have you done specifically to work with the tribal communities?
Mr. Johns.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe came to us about 4 years ago wanting to develop a solar array that would have exceeded engineering opportunities in our service territory. So we sat down with them. We talked about their desires, their needs, what they wanted to do. And we came to a compromise, and we developed a solar array that they're very happy with. It has what's called a sleeved PPA, so they buy the output of the array from us. We buy it from the developer, and then they buy it directly from us, and we have contracts in place for all of that. They're very satisfied with the outcome, very happy with that. And then we went on to develop some grant applications with the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe and Mille Lacs Electric Cooperative as well to develop essentially technology that allows them to have better reliability and better resiliency in the event of an outage. And they worked with us to develop those grants, and we're continuing to work on multiple phases of that technology. And it's really good because we get a chance to test the technology. They're achieving some of their goals of potentially having the ability to create sovereignty in the future, but also it allows us to test drive this technology that we'll potentially use throughout our service territory as time goes on.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Sir, is there anything else you've done?
Mr. Johns?
We have a what's called a Member Resource Council, and we've worked with the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe to include them. So that normally those members of that council are from the districts of our service territory, but because they're a unique community and we want to make sure that their energy needs are met, we've actually held a place on that Member Resource Council for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, and they've participated in that group and been very, they've contributed and they've shared their needs and their desires. And we actually are working with them today or now on workforce development opportunities and exploring the options of what their energy future might be. Honestly, from my perspective, I believe in the right of energy sovereignty, but the concerns that I have are more around removing the obligation to serve. There are certainly parts of tribal nations that are difficult to serve electrically, and I worry about the consideration of a utility that says, well, we don't have an obligation to serve that. It's not a defined service territory, so we'll just not invest in it anymore and not take care of it anymore. And so our partnership with the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, I would describe as vibrant. I would describe it as really healthy. And we're certainly open to the ideas of them exploring whatever energy opportunities they want in the future.
Okay, thank you. Chair, any final comments?
Sure, and that, yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. And maybe I'll start those final comments with just a response to Mr. Jan's comment around removing the obligation to serve. And with the amendment that we added today, that's no longer an issue or a concern. And so thank you for bringing that up. And maybe what I will just say, I really agree and appreciate Chair Baker's comments about it's too bad that the parties couldn't come to resolution. And I agree. It would have been great had they been able to work it out, but they couldn't. And so I think in that space, we have to come forward and help bring resolution and help bring the right and fair resolution. I will say that Mr. Johns, I apologize if I'm not saying that right, had made the comment that, the conflict within or with the Upper Sioux and the Minnesota Valley Co-op, the Upper Sioux Tribe and the Minnesota Valley Co-op, doesn't represent all interactions with co-ops or utilities and tribal communities. And that's right, it doesn't. And those that are working well and collaborating and cooperating, as he described, I think those relationships and partnerships would likely continue. And so I appreciate the conversation around the table. I think this is, again, I will just say, as Chairman Jensvold said, this isn't about solar, this is about sovereignty. And so with that, I renew my motion that House File 3458, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Acomb.
Aye.
Chair Acomb, aye. Chair Swidzinski.
No.
Chair Swidzinski, nay. Vice Chair Kraft.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kraft, aye. Vice Chair Murphy.
No.
Vice Chair Murphy, nay. Representative Anderson.
Anderson, no.
Representative Anderson, no. Representative Baker. Representative Baker, no. Representative Buck.
Huh, yes.
Representative Buck, aye. Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Carroll, aye. Representative Hollins.
Hollins, aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Igo.
No.
Representative Igo, nay. Representative Jones, excused. Representative Luger Nikolai.
Aye.
Representative Luger Nikolai, aye. Representative Mahmoud.
Aye.
Representative Mahmoud, aye. Representative Mecklen. Representative Mecklen, nay. Representative Sexton.
No.
Representative Sexton, nay. Representative Wiener. Representative Wiener, no.
With a count of 7 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail. And with that, we'll swap around here. Okay, the second bill we have on the agenda today is House File 3777. Representative Mahmoud, please proceed. And Representative, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, Chair, I'd love to move my bill.
House File, Representative Mahmoud moves House File 3777 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Oh, very good. Thank
please
you.
Tell us about your bill.
Yes, thank you so much, Chair and committee members. H3777, this bill simply does exactly what Minnesotans want it. prioritizes safe, reliable, and affordable energy. As Minnesota continues to invest in grid modernization, reliability, and a cleaner energy, it is important that affordability remains a clear priority in those decisions. Minnesota has done a great job of controlling rate increases. Residential electric rates and overall household energy bills in Minnesota remain below the national average, and they have been increasing more slowly than the national average as well. That is something policymakers, regulators, and utilities can take pride in. However, averages can sometimes hide deeper disparities. Even while statewide costs compare favorably, many households are experiencing real energy burden challenges. Today, Minnesotans owe more than $129 million in past due utility bills to regulated utilities alone. And because that figure does not include balances owed to cooperatives or municipal utilities, the true number is even higher. This bill simply reinforces a shared goal, keeping energy affordable for the people who depend on it. It clarifies that when regulators set utility rates, promoting affordable services for Minnesotans should remain a guiding principle, and that customers' ability to pay is an appropriate factor to consider. Strong utilities are essential to maintaining and improving the infrastructure that powers our homes, businesses, and communities. This bill provides clear legislative guidance. A Minnesota builds its energy future, affordability should remain front and center. It reinforces a shared commitment among regulators, utilities, policymakers, and communities to keep energy reliable while ensuring it remains within the reach for Minnesotans who depend on it every day. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to the testifier.
Thank you. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Akam, Chair Swidzinski, and members. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota. We are a 501c3 nonprofit consumer advocacy group, and I had the pleasure of speaking with many of the members prior to this hearing, so I greatly appreciate your time and speaking with me. We've been increasingly concerned about energy affordability for the reasons Representative Mahmoud just outlined and others, and so we've done our best to try to find some options for legislators to consider that could help support Minnesotans to be able to afford home energy service, keep the heat on, keep the lights on. Nothing in this bill or any of the others that you're hearing today says that anybody needs to prioritize affordability above anything else, but we think there's reasonable kind of common sense approaches to try to support Minnesotans to be able to keep their utility service. I can go over a little bit more detail of what the bill does. So section one of this bill is just a simple statement that part of the purpose of rate making by regulated utilities at the PUC is to make sure that Minnesotans can afford affordable service. I think that's widely understood to be the case, but surprisingly there's not a succinct statement to that effect in Minnesota law, which leads to some strange legal arguments sometimes when the lawyers are having to write briefs and things like that. So this was one that our lawyers felt would be just bring some clarity. From what I understand, it does not seem to be very controversial. Section two is, again, I think something that is understood, but in our opinion, missing from the law, which is that when the PUC looked at investor-owned utilities' rate of return, every investor-owned utility is entitled to a just and reasonable rate of return. That includes, you know, covering the utility's cost of capital plus a reasonable profit margin. And there's no mathematical equation to set what reasonable return would be. That's a judgment call for the commission. That's why we have a PUC. And it involves balancing shareholders, you know, interest and a return with the ratepayer needs to be able to afford their service. And so that's what our bill says. It's just that in determining what a just and reasonable return is, that the PUC must consider the customer's ability to pay that return as a part of their rates. It does not come down on any particular side as to what that consideration has to look like. And of course, it's, you know, weighing against the need to continue to make investments and all of that. And so that would be part of that consideration as well. I know there's a letter from utilities and some others that claims that simply considering the ratepayer impacts would somehow threaten safety and reliability. But I think you can read the plain language of this bill. That's not what it does. It's a simple requirement that considering a reasonable return includes considering the impact on the people that have to pay that through their electric or gas rates. And the reason that, in our opinion, this bill would be helpful is that despite, I think, this being the common understanding of how those returns should be set, utilities, when they present their request to increase the returns in a rate case, often do so without any consideration of what the ratepayer impact of that return would be. And so that would provide, in our opinion, some useful information to the Commission for their consideration of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Levin. Next testifier we have is Jim Pearson. Please make your way to the,
I'm being told I didn't have my microphone on. Sorry about that. Thank you, Ms. Levinson-Falk. Next is Jim Pearson. Please introduce yourself for the record and continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Co-Chair Swedinsky, members of the committee, my name is Jim Pearson with Xcel Energy, and I appreciate the opportunity to share our perspective on House File 3777. We share Representative Mahmoud's goal of enhancing affordability for our Minnesota customers. In fact, we work every day to provide safe, reliable, and sustainable energy at a price our customers can afford. In fact, according to EIA and U.S. Consumer Survey data, Xcel Energy residential bills increased during the period 2020 to 24 just 0.7%. compared to the national average on residential electric bills, which bumped up 4.9%. Minnesota, along with about half of the other states in the United States, follows a cost of service regulatory model. As a result, our regulators conduct a comprehensive and detailed examination of the costs we incur to run our business. Simply said, only costs deemed by regulators to be prudently incurred and in the public interest are allowed to be included in rate calculations. This model provides state regulators with tremendous insight in how we run our business. It also ensures that our rates are fair and reasonable. Our primary concern with language in HF 377 is that it amends a standard that has worked well for over 50 years and confuses it by asking regulators to consider a customer's ability to pay. With over 1.6 million electric customers in Minnesota, our customer mix is made up of all income levels. The addition of the suggested language leaves us wondering if we will be required to develop multiple new customer classes or just how a customer's ability to pay would be measured. What standard should regulators apply to determine ability to pay? So instead of simplifying the rate-making process, this language confuses and complicates it. As a result, we simply don't see how the proposal enhances affordability. We appreciate being part of the important conversation. It is a very important conversation. And I very much appreciate Representative Mahmoud taking time this week to speak with us. And obviously are very interested in continuing to engage on the bill as it moves forward. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Acom, members of the committee. Thank you for having me. My name is Zach Martin. I do government affairs for Elite Minnesota Power, based up in Duluth, Minnesota. And since it's my first time up, I'll give my annual reminder that Minnesota Power serves about 150,000 customers and some of the largest industrial customers in the nation across a 26,000 square mile service territory in northern Minnesota. And we are very unique because 73% of our energy usage comes from our industrial customer class, 14% from commercial, and 13% from residential. That's actually quite unusual in the United States. Most IOUs on the electric side, at least, have about a third from each of those three customer classes. So we stand out in that regard. And so today, I certainly appreciate the opportunity to provide comments on House File 3777 and Representative Mahmoud's bill. I do want to remind folks to keep in mind that just a few weeks ago, you know, the agencies came and presented some facts that Minnesota's residential electric bills are the fifth lowest in the country based on EIA and U.S. Department of Energy data. And that's certainly a metric that we're proud of at Minnesota Power because we serve some of the lowest income counties in the state. And so I do want to talk a little bit about our affordability programs that we have at Minnesota Power. Just something that I just want members to be aware of, that we have these and that a lot of our customers take advantage of these programs, which are really important, and we're very proud on how we've set up these programs and how they're being used. Because we do keep a sharp eye on affordability and are constantly thinking about that balance with reliability and sustainability as well. So for our programs, for example, we provide resources to customers who may be struggling to pay their electric bills, like identifying if they qualify for a state-leading rate discount program. For this program, you can either self-declare income or go through an income verification process, and you can receive 40% off of your first 600 kilowatt hours at your home. And in addition to that, we also offer a service called the Customer Affordability and Residential Electricity Service, where you can qualify for two different discounts, either a $20 flat discount on your electric bill or an affordability discount. Basically, if you're energy burdened over 3% of your electric bill, your electric bill is counting for more than 3% of your annual income, you can actually just qualify for a rate discount right on your bill. And the average discount is around 63%. So it's pretty hefty for folks that need that support. And that could range based on percentages and things like that. So we're really proud of those programs. And I do want to point out also, you may have heard Elite Minnesota Power in its acquisition. We also are setting up and applied at the PUC for an arrears forgiveness program that's worth about $3 million, where we will match 100% as folks are looking to pay back their bills. We'll match those payments at 100% and offer a $20 flat discount on those rates as well. So I just wanted to mention that today, that these are the things that utilities think about. We have folks up north that do this every day and really proud of those facts. The bill today, I share many of the things that Mr. Pearson mentioned earlier about how when you said the commission must give due consideration to a customer's ability to pay, that could be interpreted as shifting some of the priorities from reliability and safety. And we think that the statute as written balances those things and does them all together, which is really important when we think about the projects that we're building. So thank you for the chance to testify and happy to answer questions.
Thank you. That's all the testifiers that were on the list. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak to this bill? Seeing none, we can go to member questions. And Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This might be a question for, I'll throw it out there. It might be for the utilities. I appreciated the comment about, how to determine due consideration of customers' ability to pay, how to determine that. My question is, if I look previously in this statute, in lines really 120 and 121, it says that the commission and the exercise of its power shall give due consideration, same words, to the public need for adequate, efficient, and reasonable service. And my question is, that's not defined anywhere what adequate, efficient, and reasonable service is. Is it? Is that just something that has been interpreted over time? I think it might be for Mr. Pearson.
Great. Mr. Pearson can make his way back up if that's okay. Thank you, Mr. Pearson, and please just reintroduce yourself first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Jim Pearson with Xcel Energy. Representative Kraft, that's a great question. I think as I think about that answer, I think about some of the other dockets that we're involved with the commission. Obviously, we have service quality standards that are very closely looked at, and there's a long record associated with how we meet those. Same goes for obligation to serve. So I think, in fact, today we're going to hear a bill about serving our customers and what happens when non-payment, et cetera. So I think when that phrasing is sort of left open, as you pointed out, but looking at the totality of the dockets that we work with in front of the commission, a lot of those details get filled in with filings such as those.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Pearson. So I think that's my point, right, is that I think your argument was that the language customer's ability to pay was sort of vague and you'd have to figure it out. And yet we have a process where we have other things in here that are vague have been figured out in dockets over time. So I think the elevation of saying, hey, affordability and customer's ability to pay would be something that you would work out over time. And so the argument that you make doesn't make sense to me. And so I think this of elevating a customer's ability to pay could be quite interesting because there's a balance, right? Like sometimes I think in some of the programs you all have put together, and even that Elite was just talking about, sometimes it makes sense to forgive something and charge a bit less to be able to collect past due accounts. So I think this idea of affordability and what people can pay actually makes a lot of sense and can, in the end, work out to be a better thing for ratepayers.
Did you have a response, Mr.
Pearson? Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, just briefly. I think part of what I was trying to say is it does add a new layer, another layer of complexity, another docket, perhaps. And I can tell you from my experience, the Public Utilities Commission is zeroed in on affordability. We hear that through our regular proceedings every day. So affordability is clearly a value and something that they are very keen on. And I guess my point was really just, is it worth adding more complexity to the rate-making process by developing a provision around that? So hopefully that's helpful.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Mahmoud or perhaps Ms. Levinson-Falk, why do you see the need to add this? What is this adding that isn't currently taken care of in the PUC's focus on affordability? We heard from Mr. Pearson.
Ms. Levinson-Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Kraft. Thank you for the question. I don't think there's any reason this would require a separate docket or new classes of customers or any of that complication. This is written into a subdivision of a statute that specifically about what happens in a rate case and how the PUC is to consider a utility's request for a rate of return in that rate case. And what we are saying is simply that in setting and determining where on the spectrum of range of reasonableness of a return, the PUC needs to pick a spot there, and they have to use their judgment, and part of that judgment call is thinking about the impact of the cost of that return to the customers.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for clarifying that. So, right now, I could gather the PUC would look at ride things and also look at what kind of return on equity that the utility would be looking for in this. And so I think what you're just saying is if you're looking at return on equity, you should also be looking at whether the customer's ability to pay and be balancing that. Is that a good way of thinking about it?
Ms. Levinson-Falk.
Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, yes. And the reason that I apologize, I missed answering your actual specific question, but what's missing from the current process is that typically when a utility presents its analysis of its reasonable return on equity, it's missing that in customer impact portion of the equation.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, given that I've been reading up in this area and that return on equities for utilities pretty much around the country are 15 to 20% higher than they necessarily might need to be in terms of to satisfy investors. I think adding this in is a really interesting approach. So thank you.
Let's see. Any other questions or comments from members? Seeing none, we will go to the bill author for any closing comments.
Yes, members, I hope you will support this bill. It will be laid over. It's a simple bill that just centers affordability and recognizes that it's something that we all prioritize.
And with that, the bill is laid over. All right, next on our agenda here is another
bill with Representative Mahmoud. Would you like to move House File 3778?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 3778 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Great. And doesn't look like there's any amendments, so Representative, please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Wonderful. So this bill strengthens transparency in Minnesota's energy system. It requires utilities and certain cooperative electric associations to report annually the total revenue authorized by regulators and the revenue actually collected from consumers, information that already exists today but is often hard to access or understand. Transparency matters because energy affordability remains a serious challenge. More than 90,000 households were disconnected from electricity or gas in 2024 and 2025 alone among PUC-regulated utilities. And in the second half of 2024, 59% of Minnesota households reported difficulty paying usual expenses, with 36% going without basic necessities to pay their energy bill. Rural areas are especially affected with lower incomes and higher energy costs, and several greater Minnesota counties have energy burdens above 6% of household income. By making the revenue data clear and accessible, this bill helps legislators, regulators, and the public understand how authorized revenues compare to what customers actually pay. That transparency strengthens accountability, supports better decision-making, and builds trust in Minnesota's energy system as the state invests in our energy future. And with that, I'd like to move it over to our testifier.
Great. Welcome back, Ms. Levinson-Falk. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm Annie Levinson-Falk with the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota. This bill is a basic transparency proposal. What it says is that essentially for the PUC-regulated utilities, when the PUC approves their rates, the first step in doing so is to look at all of the reasonable costs of doing business over the course of a year, and it totals them into what's called an approved revenue requirement. And then the PUC projects how much energy they expect customers to purchase over the year and divide the revenue requirement by total sales to come up with the rate. So it involves a fair amount of projection. What this bill says is then would ask the utilities to come back after a year and say, you know, we were approved of a revenue requirement of X and what we actually collected was Y, so that there's some public information for the regulators and for customers and members of the public that just shows how actual dollars collected from customers compared to what was approved. I want to thank the utilities, particularly Jason Luce from CenterPoint and Jim Pearson from Xcel have both shared some information of reports that exist currently that may accomplish some or maybe even all of this. So we're in the process of sorting through that. It's surprisingly complicated to understand what is reported where and whether this is all covered by all utilities or not, which I think says something in and of itself. But if this information is being reported, that's great, and we don't, you know, in my opinion, need a duplicative requirement, but we do want to make sure that it's accessible and just transparent. So I appreciate the utilities' willingness to work with us, and we'll consider that going forward.
Great. And we do have one more testifier, Jason Luce, with the Regulatory General Counsel from CenterPoint. Welcome to committee. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, chairs and committee members. My name is Jason Luce. I'm the Associate General Counsel at CenterPoint Energy. And I appreciate the testimony here from Ms. Levinson-Falk. I'll keep my comments very brief and just note that we already do provide this information to the Public Utilities Commission, and we're more than happy to work with Ms. Levinson-Falk and any other stakeholders on providing them the information in a way in which it's easier to read or more accessible. So it's certainly something we can help with. Our concerns with the bill are simply that it's duplicative, that we already provide some information, and we're concerned about the burden on the state agencies having another filing, which is duplicative. So with that is my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Luce. I appreciate that, and I see such, you know, cooperation going on here at the testifier table. This is great.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And I don't see any other testifiers on the list. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I think we can proceed to questions or comments by any of our members. Not really seeing anyone jumping. Co-Chair Swazinski.
Thank you. And this would be to either the folks from CUB or Representative. How would this information help with rate cases? If it's already being, I mean, it sounds like generally what you're asking for is already being turned in it's already there. What would that, like, how would that help with rate cases, I guess, if this bill was to pass?
Ms. Levin.
I would just start.
Representative Mahmoud.
I would just start with, this is about transparency and making things easily accessible so that anyone really can read it. I think all of our community members who are everyday working people should be able to gather that information and understand it. It should be digestible, but I'll also hand that over to you.
Ms. Levinson-Polk.
Thank you, Chair Akam and Chair Swodzinski. I think, well, first of all, I do think that much of this information is reported by utilities that have decoupling programs where their sales are adjusted or their rates are adjusted to based on actual sales. I'm less clear how much of this is reported by utilities that don't have those type of programs, so that's the kind of stuff we're sorting through. I think once it comes to a rate case, the folks who are in the weeds of the rate case, they don't necessarily need this information or they could get it themselves. I think where it comes in handy is in between rate cases. If there's a short period in between rate cases, we can figure the utilities are probably not collecting too much money because they have come back saying we need more money to support our ongoing business. In cases where you might have a decade or something between rate cases, I think that could raise some questions. And so to me, it's more of a best practices kind of a reporting transparency kind of thing. It actually came to us because somebody had approached us saying that in Ohio, there's a mechanism for an automatic refund of excess earnings. And would something like that be appropriate in Minnesota? And we didn't actually know the degree to which that's even an issue here. But so before jumping to that kind of a conclusion, we just thought it might be helpful to have some of that just basic information accessible to the public.
Representative Susan, or Chair Swodzinski? No. Not seeing any other comments. I'm going to, before turning it back, just really thank the people who, the stakeholders who are engaging on the bill and recognizing if there's this information, at least some of it is being put out there, then it's the bill, as everybody knows, will be laid over so we can continue to work on it. And with that, I'll pass it back to the bill author for any final comments.
Yeah, thank you, Trey. Exactly that. We will continue to work on this. I understand that a number of the utilities have expressed that this information is gathered and reported, but, you know, we do want to see some transparency and making it easily accessible for others. So as it's laid over, we'll continue to work on that. So thank you to everyone.
And with that, the bill is laid over. And next on the agenda, we have House File 3912, Representative Hollins. Would you like to go ahead and move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 3912 be
laid over
for consideration in the future omnibus bill.
And I see that there's an author's amendment. Would you like to move the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my motion.
So we have the A1 before. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And with that, Representative Hollins, can you tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Swodzinski, committee members. House File 3912 is a bill about energy affordability. We know that Minnesotans are struggling to make ends meet between medical expenses, rising grocery prices, and the cost of housing. This bill does three simple things. One, it removes the ability for utilities to charge fees to customers who are above 50% of the state median income during the cold weather rule. Two, it prohibits utilities from charging reconnection fees when someone's energy utility is shut off due to non-payment. And three, it creates a regulatory framework to address energy utility late fees. I'll focus most of my comments on the late fee portion because the other parts of the bill are fairly self-explanatory. Late fees are typically 1.5% per month or higher, and the interest compounds each month. This amount could be described as predatory and does not reflect the actual collection costs for late payments on utilities. In fact, studies show that it is multiple times higher than what it costs utilities to carry the unpaid balance. These fees result in hundreds or sometimes thousands of dollars being added to customers' balances. The charges disproportionately punish low-income households, often forcing difficult choices between paying for essential power and necessities like food or medicine. House File 3912 seeks to protect low-income individuals by putting some parameters on the imposition of late fees, and it requires PUC-regulated utilities to demonstrate that the fees are just, reasonable, and in the public interest. I also wanted to note, and hopefully there was a handout that went to you folks, in case there's confusion about where this relief is most needed, please take a look at that handout. The map shows where the most and least energy burdened individuals reside by legislative district. An area is considered energy burden when they spend more than 6% of their annual income on home energy costs. As you can see, it's mostly concentrated in greater Minnesota, not in the metro area, which is also a big reason why nearly 75% of the energy assistance funding went to households outside of the seven county metro last year. As was mentioned previously with other bill presentations, Minnesotans together owe more than $129 million past due on utility bills, and more than 90,000 households were disconnected from electric or gas service for non-payment in 2025. And this figure only includes regulated utilities, not munis or co-ops, so the number is almost certainly higher. These numbers show us that Minnesotans are struggling to pay their utility bills, which means they need help, not punitive measures and additional fees. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you. First on the list, we have Annie Levinson-Falk with CUB. Go ahead and introduce yourself again and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Annie Levinson-Falk with the Citizens Utility Board. And thank you for hearing this bill. This, as Representative Holland said, this one focuses on fees that are charged to households who have already shown that they're unable to afford their basic utility service. Reconnection fees first is, you know, if somebody has let their bills go unpaid to the extent that they've been shut off from electricity or natural gas service for non-payment, that's a really severe situation. That's not something that someone would choose to do. So it's safe to assume that it's not by choice. It's, you know, that they cannot pay those bills. In that situation, to get turned on, a customer would typically set up a payment arrangement of some kind with the utility. If they can't pay the entire balance, which often they cannot, it might require a down payment of some kind. And then typically there's also a fee for reconnecting service that's added on top of that. And the utility may or may not ever be able to recoup all of that. Often there is a large degree of those past due bills that go unpaid, and that becomes bad debt that then gets passed on to all of the other ratepayers of that utility. What this bill says is that it provides relief for those customers from the reconnection fee only. It does not provide relief from any of the other past due bills, but it would consider basically the reconnection fee as kind of part of the essential part of doing business for a utility. The other part is in regards to late fees. As Representative Holland said, that the fees are quite high, typically 1.5% sometimes per month, compounding monthly, sometimes higher. So that's, you know, 18% a year. I've seen fees that are 25% a year. For many decades, this exceeded your average interest rate on a credit card. And in, you know, in CUB's opinion, from a ratepayer advocate perspective, a utility delivering an essential service shouldn't be collecting credit card level interest rates on those balances. As I said, a good portion of those balances do go unrecovered also at the end of the day and then are passed on to other ratepayers, and the late fees exacerbate that. So what this bill is seeking to do is to put some guardrails on the late fees. One of those guardrails is that the fees should be based on a reasonable approximation of the actual cost of carrying those past due balances to a utility. So it's not something that they are making money or not using to offset rates for other customers, but just covering the cost. That they wouldn't be charged to low-income households or the households that the utility isn't aware are low-income, because it's safe to assume that they are truly struggling to afford their service. And there's a number of other parameters. We are certainly open to discussing those parameters, and if folks or, you know, utilities or other feel like we haven't found the right guardrails or the best ones, we're very open to that conversation. I also wanted to flag that this is an issue in Xcel's rate cases currently before the PUC, so it is under consideration of the PUC. It's likely to come up in other rate cases going forward. There's a rate case underway almost all of the time, so is probably not practical for the legislature to wait until the PUC is done considering late fees before acting, because I think my assumption would be this is going to be a perennial issue at the Public Utilities Commission. And I think it's appropriate for the legislature to set, like I said, some parameters on what you all view is reasonable for these fees. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Levinson-Falk. Next on the testifier list is Nick Martin with Xcel Energy. Welcome to committee. Go ahead and get yourself seated. And when you do, you can introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Acom, Co-Chair Szczesinski, and members of the committee. My name is Nick Martin with Xcel Energy. Thanks for the chance to give you our perspective on this bill. I wanted to start my comments by saying and really emphasizing how much we support keeping energy bills affordable. You already heard my colleague earlier mention that average Minnesota residential electric bills for Xcel are about 31% below the national average, and again, on an average basis, about 1.3% of household income. But that said, we certainly recognize that for customers with low income, energy burden can be higher. And so in response to that, since the pandemic, Xcel has done a lot to try to increase enrollment in our affordability programs like Power On and Gas Affordability. That enrollment has grown by over 100% since the pandemic. Launched a new pilot that provides automatic bill credits to high energy burden areas, as Representative Hollins mentioned. Advocated at the federal level for full funding of LIHEAP, the federal energy assistance, and advocated at the state level for additional measures to qualify customers for affordability programs and make it easier to get enrolled. So there's a lot of things, that's sort of a sample. There's some other things we've proposed in our current rate case to really try to emphasize affordability. It's a key priority for us. And so turning to the bill, you know, we understand the goal of this bill is affordability and we support that. But for a couple of reasons, we don't think this is the best way to go about it, and I'll explain that. The first is the bill would eliminate most reconnection fees for non-payment. Those fees represent a real cost that, if it's not borne by the customer that's causing that cost, will be shifted onto all other customers. And that shifts a cost from customers who have not paid their bill onto customers who have paid their bill, which includes most low-income customers. So we're concerned about that perspective. On the late payment charges, two things. First of all, it has the same effect in some ways of shifting a cost from customers who have not paid their bill onto those who have. And second, at the PUC's specific direction, we've proposed in our current rate case a residential arrears management program, or RAMP, which is at the direction of the commission to be funded by late payment charges. So RAMP is designed to help customers reduce their arrears and avoid disconnection. Rising disconnections have been a really big concern to Xcel and to many stakeholders in the post-pandemic years. So we've instituted a broad array of measures to bring those disconnections down. We think we're starting to turn the curve. We think RAMP is an important piece of that because it would help people bring down their arrears and avoid disconnection. It would provide arrearage forgiveness to customers who have income up to 80% of area median income, who have not received LIHEAP assistance, who have a past due balance greater than $300, which would make them eligible for disconnection. And it's really designed in that way to help families who maybe make a little bit too much to qualify for LIHEAP but are still struggling to pay their bills. And it would be available year-round, including in the LIHEAP off-season. So the late payment charges would enable Xcel to launch that program this year and provide assistance to a large number of families in that way. The funding for RAMP would just largely evaporate under this bill. And then just the last point I wanted to make is that both the reconnection fees and late payment charges, I think Ms. Levinson-Falk referred to this actually, both of these issues are currently before the PUC in Xcel Energy's rate case. The PUC may decide that they want to eliminate reconnection fees. They may decide they want to eliminate late payment charges or have a discussion of whether the current level of late payment charges is the right level. They could decide all those things, and they will be reaching a decision on that by July under our rate case schedule. Thank you for considering our perspective and look forward to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Quickly before you go, can you just clarify for me and make sure I heard it right? So the ramp program is funded by late fees?
Yes, that was the, in an order in one of our dockets, we were asked to propose a program funded by late payment charges.
I see.
Modeled on an approach we had used in Colorado.
Thank you for that clarification. Appreciate it. And last on our testifier list today, we have Catherine O'Donnell with CenterPoint Energy. Welcome to committee, Ms. O'Donnell. Get yourself seated, and when you're ready, go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chairs and Committee. My name is Marty O'Donnell. Catherine, I go by Marty.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Catherine's my given name. We're in a legal place. I work for CenterPoint Energy, and I'm an operations director in the natural gas business. I've been with the company for 13 years and have held several roles, including in the billing department and for leadership roles in Home Service Plus and gas operations. And for the last 2 years, I've been a director over various functions within the gas business. Working with the customers to afford and pay their utility bills is a priority to CenterPoint Energy. Disconnecting service to a customer is our last resort. We want our customers to have the energy they need when they need it, and within their ability to pay for it. The minute someone becomes a customer with CenterPoint Energy, we begin educating them on available resources. As a new customer, they receive a welcome packet that includes information on the cold weather rule and payment assistance programs. CenterPoint provides the payment assistance program information year-round, actually, in multiple languages and through several channels. That way we reach as many customers as possible in as many ways as possible. If a customer is having trouble paying their bill, we ask them to call us to enroll in a payment plan that works for them. We don't charge late fees on past due balances once a customer has enrolled in a payment plan. Together, we work finding solutions that bring the customer's monthly balance down and identify an amount that the customer tells us that they are able to pay. During these conversations, we also consider the customer's current financial circumstances, including any recent changes, and we ask for any extenuating circumstances within the household. Throughout the year, we share cost-saving tips, tools, and resources to help make bills more manageable. CenterPoint engages in direct outreach efforts to customers designed to cross-promote Gas Affordability Program, or GAP, energy assistance through LIHEAP, and energy conservation and optimization programs. We often work with low-income organizations and state agencies to do so. Customers receiving LIHEAP may be eligible to receive additional funds through our Gas Affordability Program, also commonly known as GAP for short. And once a customer is enrolled in GAP, they're giving a flat monthly amount for their natural gas bill. And that flat amount cannot exceed 3% of their income. Customers that do have past due balances but make their monthly GAP payments receive funds to help pay down the past due balances, and they're protected from service interruption. We recognize the difficulty of disconnection for a customer. We contact a customer that may be at risk of disconnection a minimum of 6 times throughout the combination of phone calls, mail letters, and physical site visits. Utilities work with state agencies through our rate cases to balance cost impacts for all of our customers. Our reconnection fee is $28, which does not fully cover our cost to disconnect and reconnect service to customers. These costs and unpaid balances after customer assistance are largely socialized across all remaining customers. CenterPoint Energy cares about our customers, and we appreciate the opportunity to share with you some of the programs that we offer and the collaboration with our state agencies and low-income organizations. While we appreciate the intent of the bill, we cannot support it in its current form. Thank you for allowing us this time.
Thank you. I'm not seeing anyone else on the testifier list. Anyone else in the room who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll turn it back to members' questions or comments. Seeing none, I will just, before passing it back to the bill author for closing comments, say that I appreciate hearing from the utilities about some of the programs that they currently offer, and I think that highlighting that today has been helpful, and I've found it informative. So thank you to each of them for providing a little information on that. And with that, I will turn it over to Representative Hollins for any closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the utilities being here and being willing to have conversations about this, and certainly we want to continue having conversations around it. We know the bill's not in its final form, and we're open to continuing to work on it. So thank you to them for being here and testifying, and thank you to the committee for hearing the bill.
And with that, the bill is laid over. And that is the end of our agenda. So I guess we're finishing a little early today. Go forth and have fun. With that, we are adjourned.